This interview of Wisdom from the Top was recorded in 2019. From Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR, it's Wisdom from the Top. Stories of crisis, failure, turnaround, and triumph from some of the greatest leaders in the world. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, the story of Arnold Donald and Carnival.
Every year in this business, there's typhoons, cyclones, hurricanes. Every year, there's geopolitical tension. It's a recession in some part of the world. All those things are going to happen. All those things are going to happen. Assume they're going to happen. Now, how are we going to make our numbers?
How a New Orleans native turned around a cruise company sinking from a public relations disaster and made it one of the most valuable brands in its industry. So think about the complexity of running a cruise ship. The logistics alone are mind-boggling. Shepherding thousands of passengers and their luggage on and off, keeping fresh food and water on board, and then making that food good and beautiful looking. Mounting Broadway-style shows during the trip, running casinos, and that's just the ship. Now think about running the company that operates that ship, especially a company where one mishap, food poisoning, rough seas, broken toilets, can potentially sink your entire business. And in the era of Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, a cruise line has to be, well, almost perfect. So who in their right mind would want to run a cruising company? I guess the better question is, who is actually equipped to do that? And the answer, as you will hear, is Arnold Donald. Arnold took over as CEO of Carnival in 2013. And it couldn't have come at a worse time. The Great Recession had cut into people's pocketbooks, and in 2012, a ship owned by Carnival, the Costa Concordia, capsized off the coast of Italy. This was a disaster in every sense of the word. 32 people lost their lives in that tragedy. The next year, another Carnival ship, the Triumph, lost power in the Gulf of Mexico. It took 5 days for it to be towed back ashore. Passengers described overflowing toilets, sewage-soaked carpets, food shortages, and no air conditioning. So the company's owners, the Arison family, decided they needed to make a big change. And for the first time, they looked for a new leader outside the family. At the time, Arnold Donald was already a successful businessman. And by the way, he was retired. But there was something about the challenge of the situation that attracted him, because challenges and adversity were not new to Arnold Donald. In fact, he grew up in New Orleans during segregation. He was one of 5 kids, and he lived in a modest home built by his dad. And from an early age, as a young African-American kid, Arnold Donald was made very aware of what life under segregation actually meant.
I was still very young. I'm not sure if I was in kindergarten. I may have been a little bit older than kindergarten. I'm not sure. But I was in a supermarket, not too far from the house. I looked forward to Fridays when my dad would get his paycheck and I could, you know, go with him to the grocery store to make the weekly groceries. And it was always a big treat for me. But I was very curious about, there were 2 bathrooms for men. There was the gentleman's bathroom and then there was the colored bathroom. And so I was very curious about what went on in the gentleman's bathroom because I had to use the colored bathroom. And so I just snuck in and I went into the gentleman's bathroom and I came out and yanked on my dad's pant leg and I said, "Dad, you know, why is the gentleman's bathroom, you know, so clean and ours, you know, so dirty?" And, you know, the gentleman's bathroom, I remember it like it's still in my mind. It was white porcelain. It was clean and everything. And ours was like rusted tin, and the toilet paper was brown craft, and it was leaky, and water on the floor, and that kind of thing. And my dad, I'll never forget the look in his eyes. He was so afraid, and he said, "Boy, don't you ever go in that bathroom again. You understand? Don't you ever do that." And it's the first time I remember my dad kind of scolding me or anything. So I was really taken aback, and I didn't really understand what was going on. I just remember being afraid. And then he put his hand on me and he said, "Son, the reason why their bathroom is clean and ours isn't is because they have us cleaning theirs and no one cleaning ours." And I just remember like it happened yesterday.
Wow. What was your home life like?
Yeah, the home life was great. I was the baby. You got to love me. I'm the baby. You got to love me. So I had three older sisters and an older brother. And then my mom and dad took in over time 27 different foster kids. And so so there were lots of kids around and, you know, lots to do, plenty to do, plenty of fun to have. I was the baby, so, you know, I always felt like I was privileged, and it was fun. I had a great backyard. My backyard wasn't very big, but we were in the South in New Orleans, and we had banana trees, and you know, I had chickens in the backyard, and my brother, you know, for a while, I had homing pigeons, and after storms, we would get new animals. After one storm, that we had a monkey in the banana tree that we caught. We had a monkey for a while, and then I had a snapper turtle after a flood. That we had an old, one of those old washing machines that, it was a broken down washing machine we just had in the backyard. I had pets. I had, you know, dogs. I named them after celebrity dogs. So I had Ren Tin Tin, you know, who was, I called, our dog was named Rennie, but he was named after Ren Tin Tin. I had a Lassie, a collie, we call Lassie. And I had another one, a dog that looked like Roy Rogers' dog on the Roy Rogers show. We called him Bullet. So you know, it was fun.
What was your parents' view on education? I mean, was doing well at school really important to them?
It was really important to them. My parents both were from Convent, Louisiana, and they had grown up there, and neither had gone past eighth grade. My dad, because when he was of that age, there was actually no school for him to go to. My mom later, just because of situations in her family situation. But they both thought education was very, very important for all of us. So all of us, you know, all my siblings went to college. You know, several have multiple degrees and so on. But although my mom and dad didn't have that level of education, they thought it was really, really important.
Hmm. And what about your neighborhood where you grew up? Did it feel safe, or did it feel dangerous and violent?
As a little kid, of course, it felt safe because I hung out in my backyard. but once I got older, it was definitely a violent neighborhood. At one point, I think Time magazine listed the area as the murder capital in the United States or something. And so growing up, you know, you had to be alert. But, you know, you adapt to your environment. So while it was dangerous, I felt I had to be alert, but I didn't walk around afraid all the time, you know. And I had my own incidents where, you know, things happened and what have you. But, you know, I survived them all and no major injuries or anything. But it was definitely a tough neighborhood.
I read that a pretty important turning point in your childhood was when your parents enrolled you in an all-male black Catholic school.
Yeah.
And I guess you started there in middle school. How did that experience sort of, like, how would that go on to impact your life?
You know, actually, the turning point was finishing sixth grade, because when I finished elementary school, I went to a public elementary school, and when I finished it, I was going to go on to junior high, and I was prepared to go where my siblings had gone to school, Carver High School. Marshall Faulk, you know, was running back for the St. Louis Rams, and when he went there, and number of other people. I saw my first James Brown concert when I went with my brother at that high school. And I was all prepared to go there. My brother was 8 years older than me, but, you know, he was a track star and my sisters were well known and all that. And so I was going to just go to that school. But integration happened. And so it was the first year, the year I graduated, that they were integrating this one junior high school. And my mother was afraid, you know, I would get beaten up or something terrible would happen because it was a predominantly white school that they were going to send me to. And so she thought I shouldn't go. And that forced them, even though they had no money, to put me in our parish school, which was St. Philip the Apostle. And they found money somehow, and they put me there in seventh grade. And in the seventh grade class, all the boys in that class took the exam to go to St. Augustine, which was the only all-boys Catholic school that at that time black kids could go to. So it was all boys, all black Catholic high school. So I just went along with everybody else and took the test, and turned out I did very well on the test. And then I had to go through an elimination process through a summer program to go into eighth grade at St. Augustine. And my mom and dad, again, somehow they found the money to pay for eighth grade because you had to pay to go. But I was on scholarship after eighth grade for the rest of the academic scholarship for the rest of the time at the high school.
Hmm. And I heard that like every day at school there was like the same announcement over the PA system, like a few times a day. What did it say?
Yeah, three times a day. They would say, "Gentlemen, prepare yourselves. You're going to run the world." And I did it when we first walked in. They did it at lunch, and they did it at the end of the day. And the whole concept behind St. Augustine, which at that time was run by the Josephite Fathers, was to kind of correct, you know, the wrongs of society. So society was telling us, you know, the young black men, that you're a second-class citizen. You can't eat at this counter. You can't use this bathroom. You can't use this water fountain. I mean, and it was, you know, all negative, negative, negative. And they just wanted to flip the switch and say, you could be anything you want to be. But they also taught us, you know, no excuses. And they said, you know, life isn't fair. You will be wronged throughout life, but you can't let that hold you back. You have to decide what you want to do, and then you have to prepare so you have no excuses. And one of the priests had a saying, I think Vince Lombardi, you know, said it first, which was, it's not the will to win, it's the will to prepare to win. And so they really insisted on preparation, preparation, preparation. And we excelled. We excelled in athletics. We excelled in music. We excelled in academics. One of our teams won the national debate championships. Another team won the national math contest. And our, you know, football teams were stellar, and the basketball teams and so on. In fact, I think there's over 40 graduates of St. Augustine that have played in NFL, a host in the NBA, musicians, and it was a fantastic experience. And I grew up during the time of change. Civil rights, man going to the moon, you know, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, you know, I grew up during that time. And so it was a time of change and at a place that was really positively reinforcing us.
So when you were in high school and you were getting ready for college, did you, like, have a plan of what you thought your life was going to be, was going to become?
Well, somewhere along the lines, they effectively brainwashed me, and I decided I was going to be a general manager in a Fortune 50, science-based, global company. Now, nobody in my family was in business, so I had no idea what that was. But somehow I landed on that, and I mapped out a plan to do it my junior year in high school. And I mapped out a plan to achieve that. And then I executed the plan.
So when you were a kid, where did your self-motivation come from? Because, I mean, clearly you were really motivated to succeed, right, and to work hard, and inculcated with this idea that you were going to face challenges in life for reasons that were obviously unjust and unfair. But you, I mean, you clearly – you were just forging ahead. Did that idea originally come from home, from your parents?
I think it came originally from home. My youngest sister was 3 years older than me, and she really wanted to be a teacher, and she knew she wanted to be a teacher at a very young age. And I was her first student. So before I ever went to kindergarten, I could read and write and do simple arithmetic. And so she taught me those things because she needed somebody to practice on. I was her one student as she practiced teaching. And so when I finally went to school, everybody thought I was smart. And so I got a lot of positive reinforcement, but I also learned to love to read. And so I read nonstop. And when the little bookmobile would come around during the summers and you'd get a certificate at the end of the summer for reading X number of books, you know, my goal was to read that number of books in 1 week. You know, they wouldn't even let me check out as many books as I wanted to read. And I just loved reading. And through reading, there were a lot of heroes, you know. I read everything. So I read about George Washington Carver and Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois. You know, I read about military things. I read about cowboys. You know, I just read and read and read. And so I developed an intense curiosity. And so that kind of propelled me forward, and I got so much positive reinforcement along the way.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace, the all-in-one platform to establish yourself online, whether that's publishing content or running a business. With member areas, you can unlock a new revenue stream for your business and free up time in your schedule by selling access to gated content like videos, online courses, or newsletters. Check out squarespace.com/NPR for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code NPR to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Welcome back to Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. Arnold, I'm curious, when you were in high school and you were in this amazing environment, clearly all around you, and people were really trying to instill a sense of self-confidence and this idea that you could accomplish anything you wanted to. But I mean, you were still living in New Orleans just around the end of segregation. And I mean, you must have encountered moments in your high school period or before or after, where even though you were at this amazing place, you were called racist things or you encountered racism outright.
Many times.
How were you able to cope with that as a kid? I mean, did you just internalize it and move on? Or, I mean, that must have been incredibly hurtful, to say the least.
One of the very first ones that I remember, because I was so frightened, I was still in elementary school at the time. I wasn't in high school or anything. And we had Catholic youth volleyball team, boys and girls. And father took us, to play volleyball. And because it was Catholic, some of the Catholic schools or some of the other churches would allow you to play, even though it was interracial. And whereas in the school system, you couldn't do that because athletics was segregated at that time. But we went to this one community once and to play volleyball, and we had seen an ice cream shop from the bus we went on. And so while the girls were playing, we asked Father, could we walk down to the ice cream shop to get ice cream? He said, okay, you good boys, go ahead and come right back. And so we walked out, and we were elementary school kids, and we walked out. And this cop car pulled up onto the sidewalk and jumped out and had a gun, a rifle, and pinned my head up against a wall. And what are you boys doing in this neighborhood? What are you doing in this neighborhood? And, we said, we're going to get ice cream. And he said, don't lie to me, and so on. And finally, we were able to convince them. They took us back. They saw Father. They pulled him on the side, talked to him, and basically told him, you make sure you keep him in here, and that kind of thing. So, we had extreme stuff like that happening and all the subtle stuff of name calling. My high school went to court and won the rights to integrate high school athletics. And so because of that, yes, when I was marching in the band, I played alto sax in the band, I was marching in the band, people would shout out from the crowd all kinds of very negative, derogatory things, and they taught us early on. They said, look, you're going to be called names. Stuff may be thrown at you, et cetera. If you can't handle that, don't participate because it's going to happen. But here's how you need to respond, because if you respond in this way, in the end, you'll carry the day. And so they taught us and trained us and told us, no excuses. And because somebody else has a problem, don't let that become your problem, And so it was, it's good life lessons.
Wow. I know that you had scholarship offers from Princeton and Stanford and Yale, West Point, but you chose to go to Carleton College in Minnesota. So not only like from the extreme hot of New Orleans to the extreme cold, but presumably also like to a predominantly white liberal arts college in Minnesota, far away from your family. Was that a hard transition for you as an 18-year-old?
No, it wasn't a hard transition, and it was a conscious decision. So as you mentioned, I got accepted a lot of places. I had scholarship offers a lot of places because of St. Augustine. My whole track, the A track, I was on, all of us had scholarship offers almost everywhere. And the bottom line was, I decided to go to Carleton, and I thought Carleton was the right place for me. I visited the college. It was small. When I visited, I met with the, head of the physics department. I met with the head of the math department. I met with the president of the college. When I visited other colleges, it was a PhD student or a graduate student that walked me around, that kind of thing. And so I felt, wow, this place is small, 1,800 students at the time. It was in rural Minnesota, Northfield, Minnesota. And I thought to myself, how much trouble can I get in here? If I just, it's cold, I'm going to be, I'm going to focus on what I need to focus on. It'll help me be disciplined and not be overly fun loving, but still have fun. And it was a good choice for me. And the faculty were very invested in the students. You can meet with a faculty member anytime. You often had class in their home. I mean, it was just a nurturing kind of place. And that's what I thought I needed at the time. And it worked out well.
So, Arnold, when the movie version of your life is made, this part is also going to be unbelievable because from what I understand, you actually met on your visit to Carleton when you were just visiting. You met another student visiting named Hazel who also ended up going there and then became your wife.
Yes, yes. Hazel had been accepted lots of places, including Princeton. She's from Boston. She had attended what at the time was Girls Latin School. And we were brought out to visit Carleton as prospective students on the same weekend. And I walked into the chairman of the math department, being a little late like I habitually am, and sitting there was a nice head of hair facing the chairman of the math department. And I said, wow, that's going to be my wife. I didn't know what she looked like. I had not met her or anything.
Wow.
And I remember thinking in the way I would think at that time, I hope she's cute because I couldn't see her face or anything. And so luckily when she turned around, she was. But I just knew that was going to be my wife. And 2 years later, end of our sophomore year, we were married.
Amazing. That is amazing. I mean, it really does make you think about luck as an important force in the world.
Yes.
Luck that she was there the same weekend that she also chose Carleton and that she had these other amazing opportunities that both of you were there at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because you're still married today.
Yeah, we are. But yeah, it's luck, destiny. Who knows what's premonition and who knows what's what. But yeah, so, I'm from New Orleans, so that all that stuff kind of, means a little something to me. Yeah.
So I want to fast forward just a bit because I know that you went to Carleton, you and Hazel went there, and then you did an engineering degree, I think, at Washington University afterwards. And in the meantime, you were recruited by Monsanto, a company that of course, is a Fortune 100 company, recruited to go work for them.
Yep.
Like, how did that happen?
Well, at Washington University, one of my jobs was assistant to the dean of the School of Engineering. And in that role, I was to help students find summer employment and to find, permanent employment, even though I was a student myself. And in my efforts to help students with that, I met the recruiters from Monsanto, and they said, well, what about you? Well, every summer prior to that, I had worked for Exxon. But I needed to be near Washington University that first summer after I'd done my first year there. And so I ended up saying, well, sure, if there's an opportunity here in St. Louis, I'll look at it. And one thing led to another. I took a summer job with them. I had a great experience in the summer job. And they made me an offer at the end of the summer for a permanent job, subject to graduation. And I told them if it was in Chicago, in a particular division, the detergents and phosphates division at the time, because I had done my homework and that was the fast track division, then I would consider it. And normally they would not tell you where you were going to go. You went into a training pool, and when you finished training, they would assign you. So I was having them do something out of cycle for them, but they really wanted me to come. So they did it. They made the commitment. And so I chose to go with Monsanto company. I felt good about the people. I felt good about the company. And I knew I was going to Chicago because I wanted to go to the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. I'd made that determination. I need to be in Chicago to do that.
So So it was never your intention. I should say that this is like foreshadowing because you would go on to work for Monsanto for like 23 years.
Yes.
But it doesn't sound like that was your intention initially, that you were just going to go work for them for like a summer or two and figure it out.
Oh, when I first went for the summer, I had no intention, and when I first joined, that I would be permanently with them because, of course, Exxon I worked a number of summers with, and Exxon was recruiting me as well. But when I graduated from engineering school, I had like 20 job offers. Engineers were hot. I was also African American. That, you know, that made me even more unique or whatever. I went to a great engineering school at Washington University. I'd worked for Dean McKelvey. The engineering school is now named the McKelvey Engineering School. and so I had a lot of opportunities. And in the end, I chose Monsanto for the reasons I shared with you. But I didn't know, because my plan was, because I developed this plan, and my plan was not company specific. It wasn't even, you know, job area specific. It was to get certain types of skills in one job to prepare to be successful in the next one, and over time become a general manager in a science-based Fortune 50, you know, global company. And so I had no intention of like staying with one company, not staying with one company. That wasn't even in the picture.
That is such a weirdly specific goal that you had from the time you were in high school.
Yes.
I want to be a general manager.
Really,
and you
is.
Did. Like, I think at what, like age 30, 32, you actually become a general manager at Monsanto.
But it wasn't a Fortune 50, so I failed miserably. I think we were, you know, Fortune 150 or something. But really I did. And it was a great experience. I mean, unbelievable experience. Great company, great people, super people. And it led ultimately to a number of jobs after age 32. Where we, you know, helped transform a few industries. It was fantastic.
When we come back in just a minute, how Arnold Donald climbed his way up the corporate ladder all the way into early retirement, and how he came back to lead a struggling cruise company. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to Wisdom from the Top. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Hiscox. In the newly launched second season of the original podcast, Side Hustle to Small Business, they talk about how to work smarter, maintain balance, and avoid burnout, as they define what it means to turn a side gig into a small business. Get ideas and inspiration from entrepreneurs who had the courage to take their side hustle full-time in the new Side Hustle to Small Business podcast presented by Hiscox. Visit hiscox.com/sidehustle to subscribe today. Support for NPR and the following message come from Indeed. No one has a business like yours with all its strengths and challenges. To succeed, you need a hiring partner that adapts to your needs. Find great talent faster through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/wisdom. Offer good for a limited time. Terms and conditions apply. This is Wisdom from the Top. I'm Guy Raz. So over the course of 20 years, Arnold Donald achieved his high school dream of managing a major company, eventually becoming senior vice president and then president of an entire sector at Monsanto. And then he left the company in 2000. But throughout that entire time, Arnold says he never once had the urge to be a CEO.
I never once focused on titles or money. You know, it was always job content. And it was always, what am I doing? What kind of work am I doing, et cetera? And how is that preparing me to go the next level? Because my concept wasn't CEO. It was general management. You know, I wanted to manage lots of different functions globally in a science-based company, okay? And so that was really my orientation. So I never thought about CEO or not CEO or vice president or senior vice president, any of those things. And so that never dawned, you know, I never thought about it that way. But in the end, it ultimately led to all that, but that wasn't my focus.
So I guess after 23 years there, you had this opportunity, which sounds really interesting, to join a group of investors to buy Equal, the sugar substitute that Monsanto actually owned, and then they spun it out. And you guys bought it and formed a new company. How did all that happen?
Well, we were on a mission to transform the way food was produced. And we also had several other businesses at the time. But we were going to merge the company with another company, American Cyanamid, at the time. And so in the process, I got assigned to oversee a number of businesses that we were going to divest. And one of them was the Equal Sweetener business. And so how it came about was I was looking for buyers. I had a good friend from engineering school who was in private equity, had been, you know, really successful. He has partners. And so I called him and I said, 45 days, no financing contingency. Here's the number. It's a great deal. You should buy it. And he said, I believe you because you're my friend. And I believe if you say the numbers are real, I believe that. But when I go to my partners and say, give me $600 million because my friend says this is a good deal, they're going to laugh me out the room. He said, the only way this is going to work with 45 days to execute and no financing contingency. He says, so the only way this is going to work is if you join me, if you come with me. We always say we're going to do something together, so come with me. And I said, oh, come on, it's a small business. I've run billions, multi-billion dollar businesses with lots of technology. It's no technology in it. I don't think so. I said, but I tell you what, you can list me as a contingency because this is such a good deal. Once you guys get into it, you won't care whether I come or not. And he said, are you sure? He was always smarter than me. And I said, yes, I'm sure. He said, are you positive? I said, yes, I'm positive. He asked me like five times. And I said, yes. He said, okay. And so he said, I'm putting you in as a contingency. And as soon as he did that, unbeknownst to me, and it was so obvious, but I just wasn't thinking, I had to recuse myself from the business because I'm now conflicted.
Right. And you bought yourself a new job.
So I had to take myself out of the business. Monsanto wanted me to stay at Monsanto, but I couldn't work on that business for that period of time. And I had several other businesses I was overseeing, so I had plenty to do. But it did create some time, and he worked on me every day. And eventually I got to the point where because, again, I was never focused on being CEO or any of that kind of stuff. It just looked like it would be fun to do. So we did it. Yeah.
And you went on to run that company, Marisan, I think it was called?
Yeah, Marisan. We formed the company and it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun with it.
And then you were there until, I guess, 2005. And at that point, you're 51 years old. You are financially secure. Mm-hmm. You basically got to a point where you probably made more money than you ever imagined you would make in your life. And you kind of retired, I guess, right?
Yeah, I did. My wife tells me I didn't, but yeah, I thought I did. And so I, you know, stepped down and I stayed on. I was on a number of boards of companies and I started having fun and goofing off. I, you know, bought into some minor league basketball teams and, you know, was traveling the world, just having a good time.
But that was going to be the end of your corporate life.
Yeah, I had done my general management stuff. I, you know, was financially secure. I wasn't wealthy, but I was well off, and so we were fine. And you know, we just had a good time. But then I decided to give back, and so I built this crazy house. Everybody wanted to see it, and one of my best friends, who I call my wingman, Carl Sestak, had helped me with the electronics in the house, and I said, well, I'll do the first fundraiser that I host in the house, you know, on your behalf, which organization you'd like me to support. And he picked, you know, juvenile diabetes. And so we had a big fundraiser for juvenile diabetes, brought in the head of juvenile diabetes worldwide, had the governor of Missouri there, all these people in the house and all that.
And you were still in Chicago, right?
No, I was living in St. Louis. My business was in Chicago, but I was living in St. Louis.
Okay.
So this house was in St. Louis. And I brought I sat next to the guy who was running JDRF at the time and grilled him. I said, you raise a couple $100 million for research every year, so are you making any progress? I mean, what's happening? Are you getting closer to a cure? What do you do with that money? And, you know, I just grilled him. And he had really good answers. And I said, you know, if I ever decide to do anything again, the kind of thing you're doing is something I would think to do, about doing. And little did I know, but the next day, that was like on a Saturday, so that Monday or something, he let them know he was retiring. And he said, I think I found my replacement Saturday night in St. Louis.
So you eventually end up running this foundation, the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation, and then you went on to do some other nonprofit work. But what happened with Carnival? Like, I guess you get a call from the owners at some point and they say, hey, we want you to run this thing. So how did that happen?
Well, I had joined the Carnival board back in 2001, I think. And so I had been on the board almost 12 years before they approached me, almost 13, when they approached me in 2013. And how it happened was I'd been on the board and the directors had gotten to know me. And, of course, Mickey Arison, who was chairman and CEO at the time, had gotten to know me pretty well. And so when I got the call from the lead director, I was shocked. I had no idea. I had never once thought about running a company. And I almost said no on the spot because I was cruising through life. I mean, I was, I was giving back and stuff, but it wasn't what I consider full-time jobs and what have you, And so to go back into the rat race of corporate America, I wasn't sure I really wanted to do that at all. But because it was people I had so much respect for, Mickey and Stu Subotnick, the lead director, I felt I at least had to have the conversation. But in any event, after meeting with Mickey and then meeting with each of the board members individually, I realized it was a great opportunity. And in the end, it's the best job in the world, guy. I mean, I really should have been begging for the job. It's absolutely the best job in the world.
I don't know if everybody would have been begging for that job in 2013, because let me just paint a picture of what was going on. Two major crises, right? You had the crisis with a ship that capsized off the Italian coast, which was a Carnival-owned ship, which was a huge story in the news. And then in 2013, another Carnival ship suffers a power outage that affected the sanitation system. And the passengers were dealing with raw sewage. I mean, you're coming into a company that essentially is, let's face it, it was in a crisis at that point.
Well, the facts are that the company and the industry – from a financial performance standpoint, have been languishing for a number of years. There was geopolitical tensions with the Arab Spring. There was the big global economic recession. I mean, all those combination of things like a perfect storm. And the media was really negative on cruise at that time. And so when things did happen, especially like the one you mentioned where, the power outage on the one ship, the media really played it up. And so you thought it was this mega crisis when the reality was, on that one, there was no crisis. The ship didn't have power, but it was being towed. It was under control. Justifiably, understandably, there were a number of guests who were really upset. But the core business was still very good. Unbelievable product that people who cruise were not affected by any of that stuff. People who had cruised before, they were still cruising because they know what a great experience it is and what a great value it is. But to get new to cruise, it was becoming increasingly difficult because there are a lot of myths about cruising. And when you see that stuff on TV and you hear the general conversation, if you haven't cruised, it doesn't encourage you to try.
Right.
And so we needed to address that. And then that's the point in time when I came in.
I mean, at that time, 2013, the share price, I think, was around $33. And so Carnival was making money, but a lot of investors and analysts were saying that it wasn't doing nearly as well as it should have been doing given the state of the economy because it was starting to turn around at that point. So, I mean, it sounds like you wanted to take this challenge on, but I don't think it's unfair to say that there was a lot of work to do.
There was work to do, but the reality was we had a core asset that was so powerful and good. And having been on the board that long, I knew that, okay? And having cruised myself a lot, I knew that. My wife and I started cruising in the late 70s, and I had been on a lot of different cruises. And then as a member of the board, I'd been on cruise. And so I knew what we had. So I knew the core asset, and I also knew the people, which is the essence of any business. I also knew the great people we had. And so I didn't go in fearing ability to turn it around or being concerned or anything. I just went in knowing I needed to listen, and I needed to listen very carefully to everybody whether it's the cabin steward or the president, whether it's the guests, whether it's someone who had cruised or not cruised, the media, governmental officials, I needed to listen, listen, listen. And if I listened carefully enough, you know, the answers would reveal themselves because we had a core thing that was rock solid.
So Carnival, I think a lot of people don't realize, it's a huge company, is like 9 or 10 different cruise line brands, more than 100 cruise ships around the world. When you got to that job, when you got to the CEO chair, did you have a clear plan of what you wanted to do, and what was the plan?
No, I didn't. When I first got there, the only thing I knew we had to do was we had to turn the media. You know, the media was so negative, it was constantly putting negative noise out on cruise. And I knew
so
we had to address
that.
To me, it was very simple to me. First of all, I lucked up. So the day before I joined, literally the day before, they had hired a PR person, which they hadn't had. And they hired an excellent person, a guy named Roger Frizzell, who came in. And Roger's first day on the job was he found out there was going to be a new CEO. So could you imagine his feeling when he heard that? And that his first job was now to introduce this new CEO that he knew nothing about to the world, right? But in any event, I knew we had to do that, but all we had to do was expose them to cruise, to get them, as opposed to just talking about it, to visit a ship, to experience the crew, to experience the guests, to go into the engine room and see how, you know, I knew that's all we had to do. And then prepare, once they saw it and felt it, then give them the facts. And we just had to expose them to that. And we went on a mission to do that. So that was the first thing, to soften the beachhead to be able to create demand. And then the rest was then internally to organize properly, motivate the people properly, make sure we were focused on the right things. And to go back to St. Augustine, no excuses. So the reality is every year in this business, every year there's typhoons, cyclones, hurricanes. Every year, almost every year, there's a disease scare, Ebola, Zika, MERS. Every year, there's geopolitical tension. Fuel prices spike. Currencies go the wrong way. Every year, it's a recession in some part of the world. All those things are going to happen. Assume they're going to happen. Now, how are we going to make our numbers? Okay? And if you have that orientation and you prepare and you organize, it's the will to prepare, you prepare and organize around it, you can produce great results. And our team has produced really great results despite all those things the last 5 years.
So essentially you say, look, anticipate all those things that are going to happen and let's figure out before they happen how we're going to navigate those things.
Well, you got to realize that some of them you're not going to be able to navigate. They're going to ding you. So you're going to get hit. So if you're hit there, you got to make up for it somewhere else. So assume you're getting hit. How would you make up for it? And put that in your plan. But it's more than that. You know, it's first of all, organizing around the guests. You know, the essential aspect of our businesses exceed our guests' expectations. If we do that, all things are possible. If we don't do that, nothing else matters. Besides that, we're all human beings. I have kids and grandkids. I want them to breathe clean air. We take guests to beautiful places. It's really important for us those places stay beautiful. The marine needs, the life needs to be great. The reefs need to be protected. I mean, we are totally focused on that stuff because it's really what our business is. And if we ignore that, you know, we destroy our own business. And so those are the things. But getting everybody organized, oriented, focused, and then getting them to communicate, collaborate, and coordinate with each other. And that was it. Have them own the outcomes, have them own the vision, and it's been a blast. It's been a lot of fun.
Arnold, I want to talk to you about a really important part of your, like what you're known for in management, which is diversity. And a lot of Fortune 500 companies use this word, right? And a lot of them pay lip service to it. And for some people, let's not mince words. For some people, many of whom are white men, and I'm a white man, and there are white men listening to the show, and
hey,
I'm not offending them.
They're part of diversity too. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. It's important to have conversations about this because that word seems to be a trigger word for some people, like almost as if that word means they are going to be left out. So let's just start with, when I say diversity, what is that word? Like, how do you define that idea?
So diversity for me is diversity of thinking. So if you want diversity of thinking, you enhance the probability of having that if you have diverse people. Now, they have to be organized around a common objective. They have to have work processes to work together because they're different from each other. So they're not naturally going to work together all that well necessarily. You've got to have processes for that. But if you put that in place, a diverse team of people organized around a common objective will out-solution a homogeneous group of people almost every time. And almost every time if there's inclusion. So when I also hear diversity, I think of inclusion. And inclusion means everybody has a seat at the table, everybody's voice is heard, everybody is rewarded and recognized. But it's diversity of thinking. But you need diversity. I have on my ships, we have people from over 60 different countries. That's a huge amount of diversity.
Yeah.
When you think about it at the top of the organization, I engineer diversity at the top, purposefully engineer it. I have a leader for one of our largest brands, doesn't have a college degree. Hmm. That's on purpose. It's on purpose. You know, the guy whose legacy, you know, is Carnival also doesn't have a college degree. He's a multi-billionaire. So, but the point being that you want that diversity of how that person thinks differently because they haven't been processed like everybody else through the same experience.
Yeah.
You know, we have an LGBT member. I have three women. I have an African-American who never ran an operating business of any type. Okay. So when you insert these people, you have to find the core character. So it's not about credentials. You know, it's not about that stuff. It's about leadership, character, skills.
When you look at the C-suites in America, it is still predominantly white. It's still predominantly male.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about some really interesting techniques and ideas like recruiting people without traditional credentials, maybe even without college degrees. But, I mean, do you find that it's more challenging when you're looking for executive-level people? And how do you do that? Like, how do you make sure that you find diversity at those levels?
There are a lot of talented people in the world. And the reality is what it really takes is a commitment to diversity. You have to see diversity like you see profits. Nobody asks the question, hey, is it going to be difficult to have profits? I mean, it's like, you know, diversity is a core thing. And you want to you have to purposefully engineer it because people, as human beings, we naturally gather, you know, and the people that are like-minded, like values, so on and so forth. I think one of the biggest challenges to diversity is the concept of, do they fit our culture?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, right.
Because you're now starting to homogenize everything when you say that. And you're actually taking diversity out in a way. Okay. So sometimes that person that's the most disruptive, the most difficult to get along with, takes the most time in meetings, is also the disruptor.
Yeah.
And so inclusion doesn't just mean including black, white, you know, female, all that. It also means including people who are different.
I mean, it's so interesting because so many corporate leaders talk about culture. You know, we look for people who fit into our culture. But you're right. I mean, that when you focus on culture, it can often be a hindrance to diversity, right?
It can
and
be.
So, yeah, but it sounds like what you're saying is that it is not that important for everyone you hire to fit into the culture or at least buy into it right away. Is that – am I hearing that right?
Well, you know, the problem with the culture thing is how it's defined. So, you know, if somebody comes into our company and they aren't focused on exceeding guest expectations, that's not going to work. Okay, because that's what we're all about. So if you define culture that narrowly, then it would be fine. But if you define culture as you have to have a certain style of how you talk to people, you have to have a certain way of dress, you have to have a certain way. If it's that kind of culture, then no. Now you're wiping out diversity. So it depends what they mean when they say our culture. You know, that's a very generic phrase. And it's how people interpret that matters. But if everybody talks the same way and they behave and they have certain mannerisms and how they present a point and all that stuff, now you're just homogenizing and that's not good.
Yeah, I wonder how you deal with – I mean, you're running an enormous operation, 9 different companies, 9 different leaders who are reporting to you. And I think of great leaders like Barack Obama. You know, he ran an administration, right? And he had to do healthcare and financial reform, and there was a lot of compromise and a lot of things he probably wished he didn't have to compromise on, but he had to delegate things to Congress or to other folks to deal with the details, which is one style of leadership. But it means you don't always get exactly what you want. So, like, how do you do that? Do you also feel like you've just got to trust your people and delegate, even if the way they do it is not exactly the way you want it to be done?
Definitely, when it gets to the way they do it, that there are a lot of roads that'll get you to a place, okay? As long as there's a road that'll get you there, it's an okay road. And with diversity, there are going to be different ways of getting things done. And so that I'm totally fine with if they don't do it my way. However, that road has to get you there. And so what I seek is, you know, clear alignment on what we're trying to accomplish. It has to be crystal clear. And you use that as the metric. And that's what I learned, for example, from JDRF. The clear alignment there is find a cure. Is it going to get us to a cure faster?
Yeah.
And when people argue over the color of napkins at a gala, and it's multi-billionaires arguing over the color of napkins because they're emotional about the whole thing, and you say, is it going to get us to a cure faster? They calm down and realize, okay, whatever color is fine, okay? And so having that clarity of purpose is so important. And it's hard to do in business. It's easy to do with something like, you know, type 1 diabetes. But business is hard to do, but you can do it. And so you have to start with that clarity.
So, Arnold, last question that I want to ask you, which is a question I ask all my guests, is do you think you were born a leader, or do you think that's a skill that you learned over the course of your career?
I definitely think I learned over the course of a career to whatever degree I am a good, effective leader. I think I was born with some very basic things that got nurtured early, which you see in a lot of people from New Orleans. I love people. And people can feel that from me, and that causes them to open up, and they're welcoming for ideas and exchange. And so, you know, that core thing I was born with, the rest of it, you know, a lot of it I learned along the way through observation, experience, mistakes, you know, and, you know, successes that reinforce hopefully the right behaviors.
That's Arnold Donald. He's CEO of Carnival. Earlier in 2019, Carnival's share prices hit a record high, almost $70 a share. And remember how Arnold met his wife on the first day of college orientation? Well, this year, Arnold and his wife Hazel celebrate their 45th year of marriage. Thanks for listening to the show this week. The music for this episode was composed and performed by Drop Electric. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Wisdom from the Top from Luminary, Built It Productions, and NPR.